This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, July 5th, 2005. The video camera pans across Hassan An-Nima's body as it is washed in the mosque for burial. In life, he was a slender, good-looking man, usually dressed in a dark robe and white turban. Imam at a mosque in Baghdad's Adhemiya district, and a senior official of the Muslim Clerics Association. When he was first interviewed a year ago, writes Peter Beaumont in Baghdad on Sunday, July 3rd, in The Observer, Hassan supported resistance to the U.S. forces. More recently, he had dropped out of sight. Then, a little months ago, relatives say, paramilitary police commandos from Rapid Intrusion found him at a family home in the Shaab neighborhood of northern Baghdad. His capture was reported on television, and the Iraqi government contended that Hassan was a senior terrorist commander. 12 hours later, his body turned up in the morgue. What happened to him in his 24 hours in captivity was written across his body in chapters of pain, recorded by the camera and exposed by Peter Beaumont in The Observer. Today on Taking Aim, The Global Gulag, Part 4, Removing the Mask.
The article in The Observer has a headline, Revealed, Grim World of New Iraqi Torture Camps. The subheading, Secret Torture Chambers, The Brutal Interrogation of Prisoners, Murders by Paramilitaries with Links to Powerful Ministries. Foreign editor, affairs editor Peter Beaumont in Baghdad uncovers the grim trail of abuse and torture carried out by forces of the new Iraqi government. What happened to An-Nimi? It was recorded in his 24 hours in captivity, writes Beaumont, and it was written across his body in chapters of pain that were recorded by camera. Handcuffs still attached to one wrist, from which he was hanged long enough to cause his hands and wrists to swell. Burn marks on his chest. Someone had placed something very hot near his right nipple and moved it around. A little lower are a series of horizontal welts wrapping around his body and breaking the skin as they turn around his chest as if he had been beaten with something flexible, like a cable. There are multiple other injuries, a broken nose, wounds all over the body that look like cigarette burns. An arm appears to have been broken. One of the higher vertebrae is pushed inwards. There's a cluster of small, neat, circular wounds on both sides of his left knee. An-Nimi seems to have been efficiently kneecapped. It was not done with a gun. The exit wounds are identical in size to the entry wounds, which would not happen with a bullet. It appears to have been done instead with a drill. What actually killed him, however, were the bullets fired into his chest at close range by someone standing over him as he lay on the ground. The last two hit him in the head.
The gruesome detail is important. Hanging by the arms in cuffs, scorching of the body with something like an iron, and kneecapping are claimed to be prevalent in the new Iraq.
Increasingly so, he writes.
Increasingly so, and documented by Peter Beaumont again and again. Evidence is emerging that appears to substantiate these claims, and this is evidence of the investigative reporting that has been done by Peter Beaumont and other British reporters. Iraqis are making the allegations. International officials, writes Beaumont, describe the methods in disgusted but hushed tones, laying them at the door of unaccountable forces attached to the Iraq's Ministry of Interior. But let us make it clear from the beginning. What Beaumont is disclosing is the established policy of U.S. forces who train these Iraqi forces. These are not rogue paramilitary operations. These are operations of the Iraqi police, the Iraqi forces that have been set up, have been vetted, have been trained, and are led by U.S. forces.
It goes to a very important point, Maya. The theme of the Democratic Party critics of Bush is that the Iraqis themselves are not being prepared to assume responsibility for the control of Iraq at the behest of the United States. The theme of Brzezinski's critique of Bush's speech from Fort Bragg was along the same lines. The critics within the established order of the, quote, quagmire in Iraq, unquote, are concerned that the United States should not be directly involved in the implementation of occupation and control, but rather, as with Vietnam and in other arenas of interior imperial control, have a reliable series of surrogate Iraqi instruments of their rule that are no less brutal, and that is established beyond any doubt in the Observer investigative report.
6 months ago, Human Rights Watch laid out a catalog of alleged abuses being applied to those suspected of terrorism in Iraq, and they called for independent investigations. What Beaumont and other reporters are doing is showing in full detail that these are not alleged abuses, these are actual abuses, and they're abuses that have been recorded on camera. So let us no longer use words like alleged or people suspected of terrorism. This is playing into the hands of the imperial
tormentors of Iraq,
the United States, Great Britain, and all those allied with them.
Human Rights Watch described beatings, electric shocks, arbitrary arrest, forced confessions, detention without trial, Beaumont describes. He says the Observer can add its own charges. They include, he writes, the most brutal kinds of torture, methods resurrected from the time of Saddam and improved, increasingly widespread extrajudicial executions, the existence of a ghost network of detention facilities in parallel with those officially acknowledged. They exist beyond all accountability. What is most shocking is that this is done under the watchful eyes of U.S. and U.K. officials. Hassan Al-Niami may well have been an opponent. He may have had knowledge of the resistance, or he may have been someone who objected too loudly to foreign troops in Iraq. Anyone is designated a terrorist who opposes the occupation. He had no opportunity to defend himself. He had no lawyer. He had no trial. His interrogation, torture, and killing were carried out with impunity. And it is not only the case of Al-Niami, Beaumont states. All arrested by units of the Iraqi Ministry of the Interior under U.S. intelligence and military direction were tortured and subsequently killed, he writes. Post-mortem images show dozens of farmers who were seized by police as they slept in one of Baghdad's markets. Their bodies were discovered on a rubbish dump in shallow graves to the north of the city. And like Al-Niami, their bodies bore the marks of extensive torture before execution with a bullet to the head.
The face of the first body is blackened by strangulation or asphyxiation. Another has bruises to his forehead where he had been hit repeatedly with something heavy. Yet another, his hand still tied with cord, has been punched in the eye and his ankle fractured. Yet another shows signs of burning, similar to Al-Niami's. The last two have identical puncture wounds, fist width apart, suggesting the use of a spiked knuckle duster.
And then there is Tahar Mohammed Suleiman al-Mashhadani, seized from the Abu Ghraib neighborhood from early prayers with a number of other men by paramilitary police from rapid intrusion, the U.S. intelligence-directed death squad. When his body was found by family members in the morgue, he had been tortured beyond recognition. These, Beaumont states, are not isolated cases. For what is extraordinary is the utter impunity with which torture, intimidation, and murder are taking place. It is not just in Baghdad. In the majority Shia South, far from the ravages of the insurgency, there are persistent and emerging accounts of the abuses in the capital. If there is a center to this horror, it is Baghdad's Ministry of Interior and the police commando units that operate there under a U.S. direction.
A year ago, Beaumont visited this Ministry of Interior, and then he returned recently. And what he said is the worst violence is meted out in the guest house. Officials say the abuse happens on the seventh floor. One of those held at the ministry for, quote, terrorist interrogation is Ziad. It's not his real name, but since his release, the 25-year-old Sunni from the western suburbs of Baghdad lives in fear of being brought back. He's a taxi driver. A college graduate stopped his car in March to buy food in a market. When a bomb exploded nearby, Ziad, a college graduate who was driving a taxi, went to look at the damage. He was arrested at the scene by soldiers from the Iraqi National Guard, and then he was turned over to the Ministry of Interior. At first, said Ziad, he was put in a room on the seventh floor that measured only 10 feet by 12 feet. This is the size of the room. But it wasn't only Ziad who was put in this room. He was there with 60 others. They were crammed in so tightly, he could not sit. Ralph?
The conditions of torment and torture are best illuminated by the fact that you have 60 people contained in a room that is 12 feet by 10 feet. You can't have this many people in a room this size. For his, the Beaumont writes, the understatement of the year, Zaid was hung by his arms. His ordeal was to be subjected to violence by 8 guards circling him during interrogation. Zaid witnessed what happened to others brought from another detention facility, a barracks run by the Wolf Brigade, trained by U.S. Special Forces, who were kept in the same area as Zaid until his parents paid a hefty bribe for his release. Quote, I saw men from Samarra and from Medellin. They had wounds in their legs. They could not use their spoons. Their hands were destroyed. They had to hold it between their palms and move their heads to the spoon. His month in this ministry terrified Zaid. If the police come for him again, he said, he would throw himself off the balcony rather than go back. He is not the first detainee to document the abuse or to describe how the police torment prisoners. It is a common charge, as are the charges of bribery and extortion, which is the basis for the detention of large numbers of people as a source of revenue from the families.
Zaid's testimony makes a clear link between the Ministry of Interior and the torture being conducted out of sight at other centers. Iraqi and international officials have named a few of these centers. Al-Hadood prison in the Khark district of Baghdad. Another torture center is located in the basement of a clinic in the Shula district, while the Wolf Brigade is accused of running its own interrogation center, one of the worst, at the Nisour Square headquarters. Other places where interrogations have been taking place include the old National Security headquarters. Abu Ali, a 30-year-old Sunni scooped up in a mosque raid in central Baghdad, was taken to the latter, that's the old National Security headquarters, for a week in mid-May, and he was beaten on the feet, subjected to hanging by his arms, and then threatened with being sat on the, quote, bottle that is being anally penetrated if he didn't confess. It's not just in Baghdad. Arab prisoners in Kirkuk are being moved to secret detention facilities in Kurdistan, and there are other centers in Samarra, in the holy cities, and in Basra, in the south.
Beaumont states the following. The use of drills and irons during torture is documented over and over again. We have seen precisely the same evidence of torture on bodies that turn up after they have been arrested. There is a dirty war here, led by groups responsible to different leaders trained by U.S. forces. No one appears in court. What is happening to them is totally arbitrary. It is widespread. It affects everyone subject to the discipline and the control of the Iraqi authorities under U.S. direction.
Now, Observer Foreign Affairs editor Peter Beaumont, who has devoted a great deal of his reporting over the past several years to Iraq, states, quote, British and U.S. police and military officials act as advisors to Iraqi security forces. Foreign troops support Iraqi police missions. End quote. Peter Beaumont acknowledging that British and U.S. police and military officials are overseeing this terrible torture, the roundup, the terrorizing the Iraqi population, the rapid intrusion force. Ralph?
At Iraq's Ministry of Human Rights, talk about an Orwellian designation, the Iraq Ministry of Human Rights, close to the communications tower, is the location of one of the secret interrogation centers. They were marking the International Day for Victims of Torture, with officials gathered for chocolate cake and Coca-Cola under posters that read No to Torture, at the very location where one of the worst of the secret interrogation centers was situated, and where the very torture which is described here in Peter Beaumont's article was unfolding while the chocolate cake was being consumed and the Coca-Cola was being drunk. There are people in the ministry, Beaumont states, who are determined to use these means. It is their ideology. It is their strategy. They do not understand anything else, and they believe that human rights and conventions against torture are stupid. Unquote. Peter Beaumont revealed the grim world of Iraqi torture camps. The Observer in London, Sunday, July 3rd, 2005.
After the report in The Observer, the Iraqi government acknowledged that some of its security forces were resorting, quote, to the sort of torture and abuses of detainees seen under Saddam Hussein as they struggled to put down the Sunni Arab insurgents. This was reported by Mariam Karouni in Reuters from Baghdad. These things happen, we know that, Laith Kuba told a news briefing that was held in response to the Observer newspaper's details of the death squads and the torture center. It does not happen because the government approves it or adopts it as a policy. The ministers were worried, says Laith Kuba. Ralph?
6 months ago, New York-based Human Rights Watch documented what it called the routine and commonplace torture by Iraqi forces. Indeed, the Human Rights Watch report, which we will discuss in full detail in part five and the concluding part of this series, set out the reality that is described in such particularity by Peter Beaumont in The Observer. The Interior Minister, where some leaders of Saddam's former apparatus is integrated in the imposition of torture, have made it clear that these are policies that are demanded by the United States and overseen by its officials and its special forces.
Ralph, what is interesting in the report by Laith Kuba, not in the report, in the statement by Laith Kuba, and this is the official Iraqi government position, is that they're referring to the insurgency in Iraq as a Sunni Arab rebellion against the government, when in fact what we have throughout Iraq is a struggle against the U.S. occupation. And here we have the Iraqi government setting itself up, setting the situation, describing it as if there is a civil war going on in Iraq, when there is a resistance struggle against the domination by the imperial powers.
Well, actually, Liberté, the journal in Algeria, published an extraordinary account of what appears to have been an encounter only 2 weeks ago between Donald Rumsfeld and Saddam Hussein. Yes, Donald Rumsfeld in Baghdad went to see Saddam Hussein to urge him call off the resistance, in exchange for which Rumsfeld is purported to have offered Saddam Hussein a safe passage and U.S. protection in a neighboring country, no less. Saddam Hussein is quoted by Liberté as having stated to Rumsfeld, "You must be even more stupid than that idiot you call your president," Saddam Hussein stated. "You have invaded our country. You have destroyed its institutions. You have devastated our entire society. You have impoverished the Iraqi people. You have destroyed all of our social and economic gains, and you commit crimes that defy imagination, and now you're asking me to call off a resistance. There are 400,000 people under arms in the insurgency in Iraq," Saddam Hussein is said to have told Donald Rumsfeld, "and it is growing by the day, and I don't care what you do to me. You've already killed my sons and my family, and it is not a matter of Saddam Hussein." Liberté quotes him of saying to Rumsfeld, "You tell that idiot who is your president that it is he and you who should be on trial for war crimes, and you can remove yourselves as quickly as you brought yourselves here." Saddam Hussein to Donald Rumsfeld, according to Liberté in the Algerian publication.
Ralph, abduction in Iraq, standard operating procedure. Abduction also is taking place in Egypt, and we discussed the abduction by U.S. forces, the extraordinary rendition, abducting people in countries throughout the world and bringing them to countries such as Egypt or Uzbekistan, where they are tortured. But Egypt is a special case, and we're going to return to it, and this is the situation of Osama Mustafa Hassan Nasser, the man who's now at the center of the international controversy over the CIA abduction of Nasser from Milan in Italy, and where he was brought using the Gulfstream plane that we documented is that the CIA uses for its renditions to Egypt. And the reason we bring up Egypt is that in Egypt, 20,000 political prisoners are being held, and Nasser is one of them.
20,000 political prisoners in Egypt, which is the second largest recipient of U.S. aid ever since the convenient death of Gamal Abdel Nasser, which without any question has all the earmarks of an assassination. Notwithstanding that, the Mubarak regime, which is a client state of the United States, has acknowledged 20,000 political prisoners under conditions of torture, the equivalent of 100,000 people in the United States. And indeed, abduction makes few waves in Egypt because the renditions and the abductions are part of the standard policy of the masters of the regime in Egypt, the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States. The Egyptian government has long feared the rise of a resistance and has cracked down on any resistance for decades, the Chicago Tribune describes. In the Alexandria neighborhood of Muharrem Bek, the brother of the kidnapped imam from Italy, and his mother were too afraid to speak about Abu Omar. He later apologized in a telephone interview but he still refused to discuss his brother's whereabouts beyond saying he is still in prison. Don't make trouble for us. He's in prison. I can't talk about it. You know what they will do to him. Please forgive me.
And talk about it, he has reason to be frightened, because Abu Omar, now he's called Abu Omar in the Arab world, the father, Abu is father, and Omar is the eldest son. So Osama Mustafa Hassan Nassar, once he had his eldest son, once the son was born, was now called Abu Omar by family and friends. Now, he has an attorney, and his attorney, Al-Zayat, said that Abu Omar had been released by the Egyptians. He's now was missing for 2 years. The abduction took place 2 years ago, last February, and he was released 14 months after his abduction by the Egyptians released him, but he was locked up again 20 days later because he talked. Apparently, he talked too much when he was released. He called his friends in Italy and told them he had been abducted and tortured. And, of course, the Egyptians arrested him again, said Al-Zayat. Now, let's look at this abduction, because the Chicago Tribune has done impeccable reporting. John Crutzen, Tom Hundley, and Liz Sly, Tribune correspondents. Tom Hundley in Milan, Liz Sly in Rome. And this reporting has been picked up by many newspapers, such as the Los Angeles Times, Tracy Wilkinson reporting there, and other papers throughout the world. Because what the Chicago Tribune reporters did is they investigated what the Italians had uncovered in the process of this CIA extraordinary rendition. Ralph?
Well, this account in the Chicago Tribune and in other mainstream media outlets is an extraordinary unfolding of the real meaning of the policy of rendition, the body snatchers, as we've called it. And it is an extension, and we will come to this in a short time, of something called Operation Gladio. For 40 years, the Central Intelligence Agency, from the time of Alan Dulles, operated with the former intelligence apparatus of Mussolini, embedded in the Italian military intelligence and intelligence services in Italy, operated something called Operation Gladio, in which they carried out terror operations and kidnappings and even the murder of the former Prime Minister Aldo Moro, all of which was imputed to supposed left terror organizations like the Red Brigades, when in fact these were operations of the Central Intelligence Agency and its agents in Italy. Not only that, they blew up the radio station in Bologna, a model for what occurred in Madrid, and all of this is the real backdrop and background to the current crisis in Italy over the snatching of Abu Omar and his rendition to Egypt. Italians hunt covert CIA snatch squad, reports the Observer, Barbara McMahon in Rome on June 26th. Italy and the United States are embroiled in a growing row over the CIA kidnapping of a suspect, and other countries have begun to investigate America's role in the disappearance of their citizens. Canada is holding hearings into the deportations of Canadians. German prosecutors are conducting criminal investigations into the kidnappings of Germans flown to Afghanistan. In Stockholm, a parliamentary investigator has already concluded that CIA agents have violated Swedish law by kidnapping Egyptian nationals to submit them to degrading and inhuman treatment. And indeed, Paolo Cento, vice president of the Ministry of Justice Committee and the Chamber of Deputies in Italy, called on the Interior and Defense Ministers to state whether Italian authorities were involved in the rendition of Omar. We want to know if American agents have freedom of action on our territory and how this government is going to protect the prerogatives of our sovereignty, Cento declared in the Italian Chamber of Deputies.
We will return to this subject, the removing the mask, the Global Gulag Part 4, after the station identification.
Mm-hmm. Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is the place to turn to.
Oh my God. And my mother got a sudden suicide singing. Oh my God. And my mother got a sudden genocide singing. Oh my God. And my mother got a sudden suicide singing. Oh my God. My God, oh my God.
Maya Shone, our program today, The Global Gulag, Part 4, Removing the Mask. We're discussing extraordinary rendition, particularly the unmasking of the CIA operation in Italy, where there was the abduction of the deputy imam from a Milan mosque. And this is Osama Nasser Mustafa Hassan, known as Abu Omar. Ralph?
Well, as the Chicago Tribune reported on June 25th, Italy charges CIA agents in a rare act by an ally. Officials seek the arrest of U.S. agents in kidnapping an imam who was tortured in Egypt. 4 days before Osama Nasser Mustafa Hassan vanished into the thin Italian air, three middle-aged American visitors checked into a $300 a night Milan Hilton on Via Luigi Galvani. The Americans, a man and two women, might have been tourists or fashion buyers. The U.S. passports and visa cards, a driver license, the frequent flyer IDs they presented to the desk clerk were genuine enough, except that the names were bogus. So was their shared corporate address, a non-existent company with a post office box in Washington. There was a reason for the cloak and dagger business. The three Americans were really spies, the members of a covert action team assigned to snatch Hassan off the streets, ship him back to Egypt where he would be brutally tortured.
The Italian judge issued arrest warrants charging two of the three Americans, they did this in the late June, and 11 of their colleagues with illegally detaining Hassan, who worked in the Milan's Islamic community and was known there as Abu Omar. The move by the Italians took 2 years of investigation, and as we'll discuss, it was a very thorough investigation. Now, the Italian police themselves had been monitoring the Islamic Community Center, and they were surprised when Abu Omar was gone. They had been tapping his telephone, and they had been tapping the telephone of the director of the Islamic Center, too. So the puzzled police opened a missing person investigation. Now, the Tribune was able to obtain the documents of the Italian magistrates and the investigation that has been going on in the past 2 years since the abduction in February of 2002, 2 years ago. Now, they linked, according to the Tribune, these documents linked the intelligence agency with the identities, the addresses, and the cell phones used by several of the American operatives. Ralph?
The Guardian on July 2nd, John Hooper in Rome. CIA methods are exposed by kidnapping. I was walking down Via Gerzoni with my little girl, and I saw a man with a beard and a jalaba being stopped by two Westerners with mobile telephones. They were asking him in Italian for his documents, as police would do. At this junction, there was a pale-colored van on the pavement. I heard a loud noise like a thud. The van suddenly shot backwards and set off again, passing me at high speed. The three people I had seen were there no longer. One of them was Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasser, otherwise known as Abu Omar, a Muslim cleric living in Milan. His disappearance has caused an inquiry that has attracted worldwide attention. And the article states the following. The secret agents used mobile phones. They are part of a CIA special removal unit, the SRU. They whistle up private jets to fly their captives across international frontiers. They operate with impunity in every country in Europe. A Learjet took Abu Omar from the United States joint base at Aviano in Italy to another United States base at Ramstein, Germany, and then chartered a CIA Gulfstream 5 and whisked him to Cairo. Yet barely a dollar was spent on making the team's communications secure. The secret agents used ordinary mobile phones. Italian investigators quickly put names to the abductors by matching their calls to the phone contracts they had signed. And they could be sure of the team's movements because they could see when the calls had been made and from which mobile phone. The calls were traced to a phone that was returned to a U.S. diplomatic pool. It was reactivated by an American citizen using the antenna 100 yards from the U.S. Embassy in Rome.
Ralph, we should state here that in Italy, the way the justice system works, a magistrate does the investigation. And the magistrate in this case, Bertaro, had asked the court for warrants on 19 people. It's up to the judge, and the judge is Chiara Nobili, and he refused the warrants on 3 men and 3 women on the basis that they had been brought to Rome to monitor Abu Omar's movements before the abduction, but that they may not have known the reason for the surveillance, and that's why 13 warrants were issued. Spataro is persisting to get the other 6 warrants. Now, there's a 103-page document, and it consists of the transcripts of the conversations that were picked up by the police wiretaps and microphones of Abu Omar, and the Italians are using this as a basis for the for showing that there has been a kidnapping of Abu Omar. And Spataro wants to interview Abu Omar's mother, his 2 brothers, and his sister, who live in Alexandria, but the Egyptian authorities have not responded to his request. In other words, they are not cooperating with the Italians. The 18 people who were brought to Italy spent at least $150,000 at the Marriott, the Hilton, the Sheraton, and the Westin hotels. They went to fancy restaurants, and some of them even went on vacations. Among the people, and the names have been released, the names are George Purvis, Gregory Ashley, Lorenzo Carrera, Benamar Harty, Raymond Harbug, Joseph Sofin, Pila Rueda, Monica Courtney Adler, and for coordinating the kidnapping, Robert Selden Lady, for transporting the imam to Avino Air Base, Lorenzo Gabriel Carrera, Carlisle Drew Channing, Mikolas Vazulu, John Kevin Duffin, and Cynthia Dame Logan. The other people who, for whom the magistrate wants arrest warrants, the judge didn't give them, are Eliana Castaldo, Victor Castellano, John Thomas Gurley, Robert James Kirkland, and Lydia Jenkins, Liliana Brenda Ibanez, and Joseph Romano. And these are names, but when the Chicago Tribune and also the Italians went to look up these names, almost all of them were not real people. As Ralph said, the information was real, but the people weren't.
Well, Maya, it's a classic intelligence operation. It's part of the false flag. It's part of the rendition process. It's part of the body snatchers. Investigators found that he was taken to the U.S. Air Force base at Aviano. The Italian investigators have identified 23 members of the operation. They've put names to 20 of them. The special removal unit, the SRU, made several trips to Italy, and as they waited to seize Abu Omar, on the day of the abduction, the coordinator monitored events from his office. It was a coordinated operation. It was not anything about which they had any apprehension of being mm-hmm. apprehended or stopped.
Well, we should say, Ralph, why we know when the Italians know this is the CIA. One of the people, a 64-year-old man whose passport said he was born in Alaska, and a 57-year-old 30-year-old woman whose passport said she had been born in Florida, and a 50-year-old man whose passport said he had been born in the Soviet Republic of Moldavia. Now let's look at the Moldavian man. He gave his U.S. employer's address as a post office box in Arlington, Virginia, across the Potomac from Washington. His name is linked via half dozen post office boxes in the Washington and Boston areas to a Massachusetts company. Now, this is a company of which the Our Taking Aim listeners will be familiar. This is Premier Executive Transport Services. That's the nominal owner of the Gulfstream executive jet that has been spotted at the post September 11th renditions in Pakistan, in Sweden, and in Egypt. It is this Gulfstream jet that took Abu Omar from Germany. He was first taken from Ivano to Germany and then switched to the Gulfstream jet and brought to Egypt. And another of the connections to the CIA is Coughlin Enterprises, which is described as a management consulting firm, but when you call, there is no company. First, you got an answering service, and then you get an answering machine. Ralph?
Los Angeles Times, CIA leaves trail in abduction. They ran up tabs of thousands of dollars at Milan's best hotels and restaurants. They chatted easily on their cellular telephones. They gave out their passport, frequent flyer, and driver's license when booking flights and renting cars. And now they are fugitives. The Italian authorities have exposed the CIA operation here on levels that was brazen and reckless, even as it successfully spirited away targets. An Italian judge, in issuing the orders for the CIA operatives, has gone further. They are going to seek the arrest of a senior United States Air Force commander who facilitated the joint U.S.-Italian Aviano Air Force Base in northern Italy as the center for abductions of, in this case, Hassan Osama Nasser Abu Omar. In fact, the CIA station chief in Milan, the 51-year-old Honduran-born American, is named in the arrest warrants. He accompanied Abu Omar to Egypt and was present during the torture. A senior Italian judicial official stated yesterday, present during the torture, accompanied the kidnappee to Egypt, the former CIA station chief in Milan, under now indictment with arrest warrants issued. This raises the possibility, writes the Los Angeles Times, that the American agents were fully aware of the torture, to put it mildly. The man's movements were tracked back by his use of cell phones, making calls from Egypt in the 2 weeks after the disappearance of Abu Omar. He knew everything, the Italian officials said. He will be very useful in our interrogation. So we have here the clear indication of the direct role of the Central Intelligence Agency and the U.S. Air Force base in the rendition and in the torture of their kidnappee.
Ralph, let's look at who Abu Omar, that is Osama Mustafa Hassan Nasser, is, the abducted imam, because the Chicago Tribune, in extensive research again, and published two articles on July 3rd, Abducted Imam Aided CIA Ally, and they have an interview with his Albanian wife, because it is Albania where Abu Omar lived, and he had a wife in Albania, and later in Italy he married an Italian woman. But let's look at who he was, because this is rather shocking that the CIA is abducting someone who was an informant and was a valuable informant for the CIA.
And the Albanian National Intelligence Services, the Sheik. He was used by the CIA and the Sheik. They had created an anti-terrorist unit, so-called, and they deployed Abu Omar as one of their informants on Islamic and Muslim activity in Albania. He was one of their own, but he knew a lot. And one of the reasons that we have to look into for his abduction is not so much what he was doing, but what he knew about CIA operations, which they were anxious for him no longer to be in a position to disclose.
Now, the information about the relationship of Abu Omar to the CIA came from Astrid Nasifi, and she is the former second-ranking official for the Sikh. And what she said is
the Sikh is the Albanian Intelligence Service.
Right, the S-H-I-K. And the original CIA representative in the Albanian capital of Tirana, who worked in the American embassy under a diplomatic cover, his name was Mike, or that's what he was known, that's all Nasifi knew him as, Mike. And Mike spoke fluent Arabic. He set up the Sikh unit office, and he taught Nasifi and a dozen or so other Sikh operatives about so-called Islamic terrorism, how to conduct interviews, and how to monitor suspects. After he left, there was someone else who took his place, but it was Mike who actually set up the operation. And it is... Let's go into how Abu Omar got to meet the Albanian operatives and how he presented the information. Ralph.
Well, one of the things to keep in mind when they were deploying this man as an agent of the Sheikh and the CIA is that on August 27, 1995, the Egyptian foreign minister, Amr Moussa, went to Albania. And it was during the time that the Egyptian foreign minister was in Albania that Nasser began to collaborate with the Sikh and with the CIA. So what?
Now, the reason this happened is that he was rounded up. The CIA said to the Sikh that they should round up a dozen or so people, supposedly to prevent an assassination, because the Egyptian fundamentalists had tried to kill Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak during Mubarak's visit to Ethiopia. So preventative tension. Now, the CIA gave them a list, but Abu Omar, who was working for a Muslim charity, was not on the list. The CIA also gave the Sikh the license plates of four cars. One was the dark green Rover that belonged allegedly to this Muslim charity, and the car was registered to Abu Omar. So they picked him up. They searched his house. They found nothing. Nothing was found in the car. But they held him for over a week. And at first he didn't talk, but after more and more interrogation, he opened up. And what he opened up with was information about other people who belong to fundamentalist organizations. Now, these are not, they're not doing anything. They're just members of organizations. Ralph.
The Washington Post describes the treatment on July 3rd in an article called A Roman Mess. It states, the sudden disappearance of Hassan Mustafa Osama Nasser took place under conditions of torture so severe he lost a hearing in one ear, his eyesight was compromised, and he cannot use his hands. This torture took place under the observant watch of the head of Central Intelligence Agency operations while he was with the kidnappee in Cairo, removing the mask.
Now, Ralph is talking about the torture now, but we should understand that Nasser had been picked up and been working with the Albanian intelligence in the mid-1990s. In 1994, when the charity closed, Abu Omar had looked for business opportunities and wasn't able to start another business. He tried a bakery, he tried a supermarket, and then he left Albania, leaving his wife behind, and he went to Germany, and then eventually he went to, thinking that he could get asylum in Germany, but he couldn't for his wife, who was Albanian. So then he went to Italy, And that's where the saga now begins. There is no evidence in any way, shape, or form that Abu Omar is linked to any terrorist operations. Ralph?
Well, the kidnapping of Abu Omar and his rendition to Egypt has more to do with covering up the Central Intelligence Agency operations themselves and removing someone who had information that was compromising to them. But what's significant about this is the role of the CIA operatives in Italy, the impunity with which they carry out their affairs, and the fact that the Italian authorities have now been compelled to try to call a halt to something that they have obviously turned a blind eye to for a substantial period of time. One aspect of this is that there is an operation that was working in Genoa, in Italy, of the DSSA, which is a particular intelligence unit that was working in Italy in collaboration with the Central Intelligence Agency. The Genoa operation is linked to P2 and Operation Gladio. But let me emphasize again, because there's some who are attempting to suggest that it's not the CIA, but some special Pentagon unit that's involved here, which is silly in the light of the hard evidence. The realities are that Operation Gladio is not the marginal imaginings of some rogue elephant operation like the DSSA or some task unit 121 in the Pentagon. Operation Gladio has its origins with Alan Dulles. It's 40 years in its presence in Italy, kidnapping people, carrying out murder and assassinations, imputing this to the Red Brigades to destabilize the Italian government and to prepare the ground for a coup in Italy, as was accomplished in Greece. That's been the standard procedure of the role of the not just the Central Intelligence Agency, but of every administration in the United States since that of Harry Truman. So we're not dealing with some rogue operation in this particular instance, in this modern application of rendition and torture, the death squads, and the role of imperial control. We only have here the removal of the mask. Italians defend phony police, the BBC reports. A man accused of setting up a parallel secret police force in Italy has spoken out. The Genoa chief prosecutor states official police forces were not aware of the work carried out by this agency. The Department of Anti-Terrorism Strategic Studies, the DSSA, a center that monitors Islam, the daily newspaper La Repubblica cites, involving police officers using an interior ministry database to provide information for kidnappings and for parallel structures in the deaths of such as Fabrizio Quadrarocci, one of four Italians kidnapped in April 2004 and later shot dead. So what we see here is the bloody hand, the murderous arm of operations that are indeed linked to intelligence, but they answer to one master, the Central Intelligence Agency.
And that brings us to an important article by Dana Priest from Washington Post staff writer that appeared Sunday, July 3rd. Help from France, key in covert operations. Now, this is not about the Egyptian extraordinary rendition. It's about other extraordinary renditions that are, or kidnappings that are done under the guises. It refers to Christian Gonzarski, a convert to Islam. He's a metallurgist from the industrial Ruhr district in Germany, who was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where the Saudi government had put him under house arrest for an expired pilgrim visa. He was given one-way tickets back to Germany with a change of planes in Paris. Without being not to his knowledge, he was secretly escorted by undercover officers who were sitting behind him, and a CIA officer was waiting at the end of the jetway where the French authorities gently separated him, Dana Priest writes, from his family and swept him into French custody, where he remains on suspicion of, quote, associating with terrorists. What's important that emerged from this operation is the existence of Alliance Base in France that is a joint operation of the U.S., the Germans, and other Europeans, and it is funded by the CIA's counterterrorism unit. And what the reason they have it in France is that French law allows them to secret people away, to imprison them just on suspicion.
Yes, Maya, this is a very important piece in the Washington Post, Help from France, Key in Covert Operations. The operation that ensnared Gonsarski was put together at the top secret center in Paris, codename Alliance Base, as you describe. It was set up by the CIA and French intelligence services. It was funded by the CIA's counter-terrorist center. Joint intelligence work responsible for tracking and kidnapping people across Europe. The CIA declined to comment on Alliance Base, as did the spokesperson for the French embassy in Washington. But John E. McLaughlin, the former acting Central Intelligence Agency director who retired recently after a 32-year career, describe the working relationship in these operations between the CIA and their French counterparts as the best in the world. So what we're really looking at here is a coordination. Yes, sovereignty is involved, namely the operation in Italy is a violation of Italian sovereignty, but the intelligence services and the ruling class in each of these respective countries is truly at the beck and call of the global gulag. Here we have, in Agence France-Presse, the United States keeping secret prisoners on warships. The United Nations has learned that the United States is secretly detaining suspects in locations around the world, and notably aboard prison ships, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Terrorism said. These are very, very serious accusations. The United States maintains secret camps everywhere, and notably on ships, the Austrian UN official told Agence France-Presse yesterday. The official Novak and three other human rights experts announced that they were going to open an inquiry into U.S. detention camps at Guantanamo Bay and in locations around the world. We have the removal of the mask. We have the real documentation and the face of imperialism exposed for all to see. The torture, the disappearances, the reckless violation of the rights of all is a central feature of the global gulag. It is the nature and character of a decomposed capitalist state. It is the menace that faces us all.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Global Gulag, Part 4, Removing the Mask. It will be on our archive, www.takingaim.info. You can contact us at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net. And if you want cassettes or CDs, please contact us or to give us your opinions of our shows or ask questions. We'll be with you next week.